This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved. This is the author, Kate Bowler. Preface. There's a branch of Christianity that promises a cure for tragedy. It is called by many names, but most often it is nicknamed the Prosperity Gospel, for its bold, central claim that God will give you your heart's desires. Money in the bank, a healthy body, a thriving family, and boundless happiness. I grew up on the prairies of Manitoba, Canada, surrounded by communities of Mennonites. I learned at my Anabaptist Bible camp about a poor carpenter from Galilee who taught that a good life was a simple one. Though most Mennonites abandoned bonnets and buggies long ago, they kept their concerns about the greediness of modern life. Everyone had a grandpa who had once ruined a gleaming new car by painting the bumpers black to hide the chrome, and knew that the most holy words found outside of the scriptures were, "I got it on sale." But when I was 18 or so, I started hearing stories about a different kind of faith with a formula for success. And by 25, I was traveling the country interviewing the Prosperity Gospel celebrities. Eventually, I wrote the first history of the movement from beginning to end. I spent years talking to televangelists who claimed spiritual guarantees for how to receive divine money. I held hands with people in wheelchairs praying at the altar to be cured. I thought I was trying to understand how millions of North Americans had started asking God for more. How they seemed to want permission to experience the luxuries of life as a reward for good behavior. After all, the movement was best known in popular culture for Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, the de facto king and queen of 1980s televangelism. Their media empire toppled when Jim was convicted of financial fraud, and the scandal cemented in most people's minds the idea that the prosperity gospel was fundamentally about gold faucets, thick mink coats, and matching his and her Mercedes Benzes. And I did discover that the prosperity gospel encourages people, especially its leaders, to buy private jets and multi-million-dollar homes as evidence of God's love. But I also saw the desire for escape. Believers wanted an escape from poverty, failing health, and the feeling that their lives were leaky buckets. Some people wanted Bentleys, but more wanted relief from the wounds of their past and the pain of their present. People wanted salvation from bleak medical diagnoses. They wanted to see God rescue their broken teenagers or their misfiring marriages. They wanted talismans to ward off the things that go bump in the night. They wanted a modicum of power over the things that rip their lives apart at the seams. The prosperity gospel is a theodicy, an explanation for the problem of evil. It is an answer to the questions that take our lives apart. Why do some people get healed and some people don't? Why do some people leap and land on their feet while others tumble all the way down? Why do some babies die in their cribs and some bitter souls live to see their great-grandchildren? The prosperity gospel looks at the world as it is and promises a solution. It guarantees that faith will always make a way. I would love to report that what I found in the prosperity gospel was something so foreign and terrible to me that I was warned away. But what I discovered was both familiar and painfully sweet. The promise that I could curate my life, minimize my losses, and stand on my successes. And no matter how many times I rolled my eyes at the creed's outrageous certainties, I craved them just the same. I had my own prosperity gospel, a flowering weed grown in with all the rest. Married in my 20s, a baby in my 30s, I won a job at my alma mater straight out of graduate school. I felt breathless with the possibilities. Actually, it's getting harder to remember what it felt like, but I don't think it was anything as simple as pride. It was certainty, plain and simple, that God had a worthy plan for my life in which every setback would also be a step forward. I wanted God to make me good and make me faithful, with just a few shining accolades along the way. Anything would do if hardships were only detours on my long life's journey. I believed God would make a way. I don't believe that anymore. One moment, I was a regular person with regular problems. And the next, I was someone with cancer. Before my mind could apprehend it, it was there, swelling to take up every space my imagination could touch. The new and unwanted reality. There was a before, and now there was an after. Time slowed to a pulse. Am I breathing? I wondered. Do I want to? Every day I prayed the same prayer. God, save me, save me, save me. Oh God, remember my baby boy. Remember my son and my husband before you return me to ashes, before they walk this earth alone. I pled with a God of maybe, who may or may not let me collect more years. It is a God I love, and a God that breaks my heart. Anyone who has lived in the aftermath of something like this knows that it signifies the arrival of three questions so simple that they seem, in turn, too shallow and too deep. Why? God, are you here? What does this suffering mean? At first, those questions had enormous weight and urgency. I could hear him. I could almost make out an answer. But then it was drowned out by what I've now heard 1,000 times. Everything happens for a reason, or God is writing a better story. Apparently, God is also busy going around closing doors and opening windows. He can't get enough of that. The world of certainty had ended, and so many people seemed to know why. Most of their explanations were reassurances that even this is a secret plan to improve me. God has a better plan. This is a test, and it will make you stronger. Sometimes these explanations were peppered with scriptures like, "We know that for those who love God, all things work together for good," Romans 8:28. Except that the author, Paul, worshipped God with every breath until his body was dumped in an unmarked grave. But I knew what they were saying. It would be nice if catastrophes were divine conspiracies to undo what time and unfaithfulness had done to my wandering soul. Other people wanted to assure me that what I'd had was enough. At least you have your son. At least you've had an amazing marriage. I had been stripped down to the studs, and everything of worth I had accumulated was being appraised with a keen eye. I became certain that when I died, some beautiful moron would tell my husband that, quote, God needed an angel, because God is sadistic like that. This is what I thought about sometimes. What people would say to the man with sandy hair and eyes that I'd loved since we were 15 and thought we would never die. I don't think I knew enough about longing 10 years ago, when I started investigating the prosperity gospel. I had just bought a little house with the man I loved, filled it with books, IKEA furniture, and a soft dog with legs as stout as soup cans. I was steeped in the lore of eternal youth. My life was something that I could mold, or at least correct with a surge of determination. It was the same unlimited confidence that the prosperity gospel calls victory. And I might have chalked up my successes to my own hard work and a little luck. Nothing was broken yet that could not be fixed. But what gives the prosperity movement breadth and depth for many is its thorough accounting for the pain of life and for the longing we have for restoration. Those Americans trapped in failing bodies or broken relationships, or the painful possibility that their lives might never be made whole, can turn to this message of hope. If it is a game, with rules for success that anyone can use, then maybe they can win. I wish this were a different kind of story. But this is a book about befores and afters, and how people in the midst of pain make up their minds about the eternal questions. Why? Why is this happening to me? What could I have done differently? Does everything actually happen for a reason? If I accept that what is happening is something I cannot change, can I learn how to let go? Chapter 1. Diagnosis. I had lost almost 30 pounds by the time I was referred to a gastrointestinal surgeon at Duke University Hospital. Every few hours, I doubled over from a stabbing pain in my stomach. This had happened so often over the last 3 months that I had developed a little ritual for it. Reach for the nearest wall with the right hand, clutch my stomach with the left hand, close my eyes, keep perfectly silent. When the pain subsided, I would reach into my purse, take a swig from a giant bottle of antacid, stand up straight, and resume whatever I was doing without comment. It was a little creepy to watch, I'm sure, but it was the best I could do at pretending for so long. Now I was tired of pretending. I eyed the surgeon warily as he came into the small examining room where my husband, Tobin, and I waited. He sat down heavily on his stool, sighing as if already annoyed. Then he said, "Well, I looked at your latest tests, and they don't tell us anything conclusive." "I don't understand," I protested. "I thought the last test suggested it was probably my gallbladder." "It's not entirely clear," he said in a hard voice. "So you're not prepared to operate?" "Look, there is nothing to suggest that we are going after the right thing. I can take out your gallbladder, and you might be in the same pain you're in today, plus the pain and inconvenience of the surgery." I sighed. "I don't know how to get you or anyone to pay attention. I've been to all your specialists. But I have been in a crazy amount of pain for 3 months now, and I can't keep doing this." "Look," he said, as if having to start all over again, "we're at the squishy end of an already squishy diagnosis." He throws it back at me, nonchalant. "Again, I can take it out, but I don't know what you want me to say." "I want you to say that you're not going to rule out the gallbladder surgery and just send me back out there with everyone else. No one is trying to help me solve this, and I can't take it anymore." I could hear the desperation leaking out. "I'm sorry you feel that way," he said. We sat there, glaring at each other. "I'm not leaving," I said loudly. "I am not leaving until you send me for another test." "Okay, fine," he said, and he rolled his eyes. "Okay." He wrote a note to authorize a CT scan, and I felt only relieved annoyance. They would find something simple, and that would be the end of it. I'd just have to schedule my life around a surgery. Nothing major. I'm at the office, pacing at my treadmill desk and flipping through my latest research, when my phone rings. "Hello, this is Kate." It's Jan from the doctor's office. She has a little speech prepared, but my mind is zeroing in and out. I can hear that she is talking, but I can't make out the words. "It is not my gallbladder. I catch that much. But now it is everywhere." "What's everywhere now?" I ask. "Cancer." I listen to the buzz of the phone. "Ms. Bowler?" I absentmindedly put it back up to my ear. "Yes?" "We're going to need you to come into the hospital right away." "Sure, sure. I need to call Tobin." "Ma'am?" "No, sure, I get it. I'll be right there." "I'll send someone down to the lobby to get you." "Ma'am?" "Sure, sure," I say, almost inaudibly. "I have a son. It's just that I have a son. There's a long silence. Yes, she says. I'm sorry. She pauses. I picture her, standing near an office phone, riffling through charts. Likely there are more people to call. But we're going to need you to come in. Is God good? Is God fair? A hulking Norwegian asked me this once in the line at my college cafeteria. I think so, I said, but it's 7 a.m. and I'm starving. But now I wonder, does God even care? One of my favorite stories, told by prosperity preachers, comes from one of the original televangelism duos, Gloria Copeland and her husband, Kenneth. Gloria, who, even at 70-something, looks like a glamour-puss real estate agent, and her husband, a true Texan, who always looks like he has strolled in after a leisurely day at the ranch. For decades, they have saturated primetime television and the Christian bookstore shelves with teachings on living the abundant life. They don't expect God simply to be fair. They expect God to rain down blessings. So when a tornado threatened to destroy their home, said Gloria, they crept in the night to their porch to face down the storm. They prayed loud and long that God would protect their property and, for good measure, commanded God to protect their neighbors' houses too. And so, they said, the storm turned and went another way. It is an image I cannot forget. Two of the world's wealthiest Christians shaking their fists at the sky, protesting to the God of fair. After all, what father, when his child asks for bread, would give him a stone? Fairness is one of the most compelling claims of the American dream, a vision of success propelled by hard work, determination, and maybe the occasional pair of bootstraps. Wherever I have lived in North America, I have been sold a story about an unlimited horizon and the personal characteristics that are required to waltz toward it. It is the language of entitlements. It is the careful math of deserving, meted out as painstakingly as my sister and I used to inventory and trade our Halloween candy. In this world, I deserve what I get. I earn my keep and keep my share. In a world of fair, nothing clung to can ever slip away. I got married at 22 when I was especially dumb. I wasn't dumb to marry Tobin, exactly, because that ended up being one of the most sensible things I've ever done. But I was probably pretty dumb, because I didn't yet realize that Tobin was one of those great investment pieces that increase in value but seem like overkill. He was like beachfront property when I probably could have settled for a suburban condo. At the time, however, I mostly thought about how beautiful he was, how great he was at explaining the finer points of skateboarding, and how he would never lose his hair. Now he rushes into my office and throws his arms around my neck, and all the words are pouring out. I have loved you forever. I have loved you forever. Please take care of our son. I will, he cries, and I know it is true. But the truth is not going to help us anymore. I call my parents on the walk to the hospital, but I have to stop and lean against a high stone wall for a minute. Tobin puts his hand on my back to steady me. We are both gone, gone, gone somewhere else, flitting back and forth between now and where we used to be. I tell my parents they need to find a place to be together and sit down, that I have been told that I have cancer and that it doesn't look good for me. You'll need to give Zach to us. You have to change your will, my mom blurts out, her voice shaking. I have been, coincidentally, drawing up a living will for my life insurance policy, a policy I will be denied because they will find out that I have cancer and reject the claim. a bet they no longer want to take. But right now my mother is confused. Her child is dying, and suddenly so is the whole world. She is desperate to salvage what is left of my life, my son. Tobin will keep living, Mom. Zach can stay with him, I say gently. Right, right, I'm sorry. Oh, honey, I'm sorry, she says. And I can tell that she is resolved to be my rock, but she is crying. They are on a trip to Toronto to see my sister Amy, and now they will scatter in the winds and find me. I will see my dad in the hospital when he strides in moments before my surgery. He will take my hand in one hand and stroke my hair with the other. This is my father, the impervious giant, who will never cry about my diagnosis. He will not allow it the dignity of defining a damn thing about his daughter and her future. I call my sisters, and they dutifully sit. Our words feel garbled, burning hot with love. My next call finds my friend Catherine in the bleachers of a Vanderbilt football game, and she will immediately get into the car, a state away, screaming into the windshield. When I wake up from surgery, she will be there, and my foggy brain will not recall that I never asked her to come. She knew I needed her. She will sleep in the hospital chair beside me, pretending it is comfortable, and using her no-nonsense voice with the nurse who won't bring me ice chips. But for now, I am sitting in a hospital room, before surgery, somewhere in the maze of Duke University Hospital, staring down at my hands folded on my lap. A blue hospital gown is folded crisply on the bed beside me, and machines chirp everywhere like crickets. I am alone for the first time since my diagnosis a few hours before, and the day is unfolding with brutal swiftness. Tobin has raced home to tell Zach's indomitable nanny about what is happening, and all my family is still in transit. And I can't do anything but sit, staring down at my dress, white with bright flowers and flouncy the way I like it. I love this dress. I can't take it off. I need it for teaching. My friends, Jonathan and Beth, arrive. Jonathan races through the door and pulls me into a bear hug. They plunk themselves down on my hospital bed and turn to me with looks of compassionate dismay. I'm going to need for you to burn this, I say, finally, gesturing exasperatedly to my dress. I can't see it again. That life is over. I am oscillating between hysteria and an executioner's humor. I'm just the luckiest girl in the world, I say with mock enthusiasm before my mind skips to Zach long enough to send me into racking sobs. I double over crying. I squeeze my eyes closed and try to shut out the world. I just don't, I keep saying. I just don't know what to do. The only things that feel real are their hands patting my back and the hospital sheets against my face. I just don't know what to do. Die, says Beth in a quiet voice. I don't know if it was a question or a fact, but I stop crying. Her word is a cliff, and I can see all the way down. Jonathan starts to reassure me to fill the void and remake the world as it was, but all I can think of is her single word. Die. It is impossible. It is an impossible thought. I thought this life was only getting started, but now I'm supposed to contemplate its sudden conclusion. I am supposed to imagine the end of my whirling mind, the slowing of my breath, a sunken vessel where my heart now beats. But worse, it would be the conclusion of this thing I had built. A family. I have had two perfect moments in my life. The first was running down the aisle with Tobin on our wedding day. and we burst through the church doors and stood, breathless, alone as husband and wife, gazing at each other like complete idiots. And the other was when they put Zach in my arms for the first time, and we looked at each other like it was a conspiracy of mutual adoration. These are my impossible thoughts. These are my can't-live-withouts. I cannot picture a world where I am not theirs, where I am simply gone. Jonathan and Beth pray for me for a long time, and they put their hands on my head to bless me and kiss my wet cheeks before leaving, but not before I get Beth to wait a minute. I pull off my dress and put on the gown, clumsily knotting the ties at my back as she helps me. I hand her the dress. She knows what to do. Chapter 2. Object Lesson. My body had failed me before. I was 28 and working on my dissertation, a book-length treatment of the prosperity gospel, and the final step on my way to being a professor, when, one afternoon, my fingers suddenly slowed and then stopped at the keyboard. I had spent long hours at the computer, but nothing seemed to warrant this surreal limpness, which extended from my shoulders to my fingertips. My arms had a limited battery life, able to hold things or write a letter 1 minute, and then peter out the next. In the middle of a car ride, I would suddenly be unable to grip the steering wheel anymore. Shaking people's hands was fast becoming the most awkward moment of any day. "Oh, hello there. Don't mind the fact that I don't seem to be gripping your hand, but that you are expertly moving my arm up and down." By day, I had to make endless accommodations for the weakness in my arms, in the way I answered email, graded papers, chopped ingredients for dinner, and went to the gym. I spent hours in the bathtub soaked in Epsom salts. I cried in the shower when I thought Tobin was upstairs. Sometimes I gave up and put both arms in slings or braces and let them hang there like the world's most awkward conversation pieces. What can you do with only sporadic use of your arms? Life had become an obstacle course of things to be overcome to the sound of a ticking clock. But by night, when my research into prosperity churches came to life in healing revivals, church services, and interviews in the pews, my arms were not just a hindrance. They were an object lesson. It wasn't only that I couldn't take notes nearly as well, and I had to record things, only for them to be painstakingly transcribed later by voice dictation. But if you had seen me there, you would have witnessed a girl in double arm braces at a healing crusade, swarmed by teachers, evangelists, healers, and prophets like moths to a flame. People wanted to see me pushed up to the stage to be healed by a celebrated man of God, or brushed to the side with teams of women touching my arms, my back, my head, and laboring over me in prayer. Sometimes I received an invitation to a quiet room to go over a checklist of sins I might have committed that would have opened the door to the ministrations of demons, with names like Python, Citri, and Thassico. What or who, my helpers wanted to know, was squeezing the life out of me? They took spiritual inventories, paging through my life and taking out events one by one for examination. Was this it? What darkness could God's light expose? In a spiritual world in which healing is a divine right, illness is a symptom of unconfessed sin, a symptom of a lack of forgiveness, unfaithfulness, unexamined attitudes, or careless words. A suffering believer is a puzzle to be solved. What had caused this to happen? As I walked around with slings or braces on my arms, I heard whispers and caught looks, some sympathetic, some disapproving, some gravely concerned. In the small church where I did most of my research, I knew I was loved. I was prayed for. I was ministered to. But when, week after week, I returned with the same droop in my arms and weakness in my hands, I thought I saw their lips close and their arms cross, and I felt like faithlessness personified. Over the next 6 months, I visited more than 35 doctors to try to make sense of what was happening to me. My first appointment was disheartening. "I think your injury is..." The doctor paused, turning to the physician he had brought in for consultation. They shared a long silence between them.
"Well," continued the other, "it can be common in women who share a certain size."
One of the doctors had been, unconsciously, miming the shape of breasts on his own chest for the last few seconds. I was ready to get to the end of this as quickly as possible. "When a woman of your, proportions does too much yoga, then it can create certain kinds of injuries. Nerve entrapment in your chest, here and here," he said, pointing. "Which explains the numbness you're feeling in your arms. So ease up on the yoga," he said with a chuckle. I stuffed my paperwork into my backpack as quickly as possible and scooted out the door. I rarely do yoga, and I certainly was not, what's the polite word here, encumbered? "That's the third yoga injury we've seen like that this week," I heard one say to the other before I shut the door behind me. A veritable epidemic of well-endowed yogis. I was sad and angry in equal measure most of the time. I would be angry at my arms, and then I'd start to cry. I was constantly stewing over daily advice from friends and strangers who spied my slings and warmly recommended that I get carpal tunnel surgery. And when I sat down to work, I usually worried that my frustrated crying was going to short-circuit my laptop. There was nothing close to strength left in my arms, and I had a 300-page dissertation to write. Every day I tried voice dictation software, but it skipped all over the paragraph and garbled most of the words. Prosperity Gospel always read Perspiring Gospel, but "This computer is ruining my life" always seemed to come out perfectly. Eventually, my creeping depression convinced Tobin and my mother and father that I should move back home to Canada for a month so my professor parents could pretend that they didn't have jobs and help me full-time. And they did. They took the dissertation down by dictation. Word for word. I sat on the couch surrounded by books and tried to arrange my ideas into sentences. And my mom or dad sat across from me, pretending that each thought was riveting. Apart from that, we watched Law and Order episodes and ate Chinese takeout. My body was failing me, failing all of us. Pain rippled through my limp arms. I was no longer proof of anything that testified to the glory of God, at least not in the eyes of the people around me. I was nothing like a sign and a wonder. Instead, I was living in my parents' basement, and I simmered with resentment. Wasn't I better than this? "I used to be shiny," I said to a friend with a sour laugh. "I really was pretty shiny at one point." If you ask people in the prosperity movement how they know their lives are headed in the right direction, they talk a lot about proof. The lame will walk. The blind will see. Bills will be paid. Wives will drive gleaming cars. Children will put on neatly pressed clothes with price tags still popping out of their collars. All evidence of who God loves. It was even the theme song for prosperity teacher Frederick Price's television show. "Evidence, evidence, do you need it?" sang the choir. The gospel would prove itself. but I long to prove it too. There is something so American about the show and tell of our daily lives. A big house means you work hard. A pretty wife means you must be rich. A subscription to the New York Times shows you must be smart. And when you're not sure, there will always be bumper stickers to point out who has the honor roll student and who finished a marathon. America likes its shopping malls big and its churches even bigger. And every Starbucks in every lobby proves that Jesus cares about brewing the best. Sometimes I saw this idea under the banner of family values. It was in the way women boasted about their fat-cheeked babies and their little boys in bow ties. It was in the way the pastor displayed his wife and child in the front row and asked his little Jennifer to sing the solo. Isn't she talented, folks? It was in the way people bought tidy mansions with extra guest rooms in case a refugee sponsored by the church needed to stay a night. Christmas cards were prosperity gospels writ miniature. Stacks of pictures of a family in matching denim, sitting on lightly distressed couches in fields of waving wheat. Does every field in America have a photo couch? But I was taken with the white light brightening their smiles as they turned to each other and laughed. They were the good news. Some bodies can't bear up under this regime of divine perfection. A friend of mine looked at his newborn daughter, dewy from birth, and could not acknowledge what he saw with his own eyes. She was plump and pink, with the lightly hooded eyes of a perfect child, but a perfect child with Down syndrome. Despite all the love in his heart, or perhaps because of it, he could not say those words aloud. Down syndrome. And that sliver of iron became a commitment never to proclaim, never to negatively confess, that his baby girl was anything less than typical. He began to believe that the God of all that is whole and complete would make his daughter so, even if it was not until Judgment Day, when Jesus came through the clouds. What would it mean for Christians to give up that little piece of the American dream that says, "You are limitless"? Everything is not possible. The mighty kingdom of God is not yet here. What if rich did not have to mean wealthy, and whole did not have to mean healed? What if being people of the gospel meant that we are simply people with good news? God is here. We are loved. It is enough. I received this friend's Christmas card in the mail not long after his daughter was born and stared at it on the fridge. The sun shone behind their heads, upturned in laughter, the baby on his lap, a gaggle of children hanging off of their mother. I exhaled slowly. I suddenly longed to have the strength to pick that baby up and hold her eye to eye so I could say the words that I longed to hear. You are perfect, my darling, just as you are. You are the gospel. That was the Christmas when I sat across from yet another doctor, a small man leaning into a desk littered with papers, who made it quite clear that he was terribly important, and, as far as I was concerned, the final word. He asked me questions, but mostly he seemed preoccupied by the sheer number of doctors I'd seen. He sounded skeptical, as if all those doctors should have amounted to a cause already. I believe your symptoms are psychosomatic, so all I can recommend is a good psychologist, he said firmly. You think these are invented symptoms resulting from mental problems? I asked in astonishment. My arms stopped working because I used them too much while writing my dissertation, and now we just have to figure out why. I steamed. He might have been describing a complicated psychosomatic disorder that I have seen with my own eyes. A father dies, and suddenly his daughter cannot move her legs. A schoolchild is petrified and suddenly feels his throat close up, unable to squeak out a word. It can happen, and it can last for months, years. But I don't think that's what he is seeing. He saw an insignificant young woman with floppy arms, unable to write. And I saw a doctor who refused to put his shoulder to this problem and help me. He was my final stop on the long list of doctors I had met, and I thought he was my best hope. Now all I could see were the adult braces on his teeth and the way his lips curled around them as he told me that the stress of dissertation writing had clearly gotten to me. He jotted down in my file that I required psychological assistance. Now no one would take my physical condition seriously. Don't help me. Nothing to see here. I stormed out the door as quickly as possible to keep myself from crying and giving him another excuse to think I was unstable. I strode through the hallways until I was out of sight and then slumped down on the floor to call Chelsea. Chelsea and I have spent most of our lives together, and she set in stone for me what it means to feel loved and understood. In high school, she learned to forgive me for our time at the same childhood judo camp, where I accidentally became her sworn enemy by repeatedly flipping her over my 11-year-old hip and asking her, while she was flat on her back, if she had had her Wheaties today. Long ago, we realized that everything that happens to one of us happens to both of us, so we treat our lives like a tandem bicycle. Where she goes, I go, but we both look a little ridiculous. We both grew up with unlimited hope that life was fair. But that confidence began to crumble in our hands as our 20s wore on. I lost control of my body. She lost a marriage when her husband's immigration visa didn't come through. Together, we lost faith in the whole concept of things being fair. Fair would insist that people wouldn't have to use smiley or frowny stamps to grade their students' final papers, because the instructor's arm was not capable of holding a pen. This cheerful stamp conveys that this paper makes me feel, stamps page, extremely happy about your detailed thesis statement. Justice would grant citizenship to tired immigrants who, as children, fled silently into the dark when gunshots and thick smoke filled the village air. Children hoping that no one could hear the soft padding of their bare feet in the tall grasses. Fair would mean that life rewarded the good and punished the bad, or at least pretended to. The prosperity gospel has a very simple way of explaining why life, as it is, must be inherently just. As it is told, God established a set of principles that keep the world in order. Just as there are natural laws of gravity and thermodynamics, there are spiritual laws that steer the courses of lives and ensure that good things really do happen to good people. The law of confession activates the power of positive thoughts, drawing our desires out of the heavens and into reality. The law of agreement allows two or more people to harness their spirituality corporately to create an answer to prayer. The law of the tithe supernaturally multiplies an offering of 10% gross income given to the church, often with a guaranteed tenfold or hundredfold return. The number of these spiritual laws depends on who is preaching. There are the law of first fruits and the law of seed faith, and an entire Laws of Life book series by the televangelist Mike Murdoch, advertised as people's favorite book outside the Bible. It's also the same premise as anything your aunt sent you about the Oprah-endorsed book, The Secret. Spoiler alert, the secret is to think positively. Spiritual laws offer an elegant solution to the problem of unfairness. They create a Newtonian universe in which the chaos of the world seems reducible to simple cause and effect. The stories of people's lives can be plotted by whether or not they follow the rules. In this world, there is no such thing as undeserved pain. there is no word for tragedy. There was a moment in the midst of my arm debacle when I thought I had found a way out of the seemingly endless cycle of hope and disappointment. I had agreed to some kind of surgery, and while I was lying in the hospital bed, waiting to be wheeled in, the nurses ran through all the typical intake questions. "Is there any chance you're pregnant?" one asked. "No, I'm afraid not," I said, and looked at Tobin for a hard minute. We had been hoping to start a family for several years. Each month came and went, marked only by discarded pregnancy tests and a swelling silence between us about whether we were simply unlucky. Or worse. Surgery would delay the possibility of fertility treatments in what felt like a fading season. I returned to watching Law and Order on the television, pegged to the hospital ceiling, while Tobin worked at his computer in the chair beside me. Then there was a squeal of delight and multiple gasps, and then what felt like a dozen nurses pushed aside the curtain and stood over us. "Well, honey," said one of them, "looks like you're not going to be going into surgery today." He looked at me knowingly until I could feel my eyes fill with tears and my heart start to race, but I couldn't say the words. "You're pregnant!" he exclaimed, and all the nurses started clapping. Tobin reached out and pulled me to him, and we could hardly believe the delighted shrieks around us. I put my hand on my stomach. This was my miracle. We talked fast and giddy on the way home, as if the car had been pumped full of ether. We were overcome with love, love for each other, love for this baby, love for this future. By the time we had gotten home from the hospital, I had had some strong feelings about using my dad's middle name if it was a boy, and Tobin was convinced that all the best girl names were taken. We were high on possibility. We dithered and fussed around the house, unable to fully concentrate on anything except when we were allowed to tell our parents. But it had already begun. I felt something strange and ran to the bathroom. I started to scream for Tobin. As I sat crouched there, everything moved around me in a blur. Tobin with his arms around me, my stomach sore from deep shaking sobs, my own rage at having fallen in love with this 3-hour dream. When we had said all we could say, and I had cried all I could cry, we stood there like fools, without language or focus. Tobin finally left to make coffee, to have something to do and to hold in his hands, but I couldn't bring myself to leave the bathroom. I undressed and turned on the hot water of the shower. I stepped inside, pressed my cheek against the cool tile of the wall, and closed my eyes. I could not look down. I was nothing but blood and water. Chapter 3. Magic Tricks. My friend Blair once invited me to a magical extravaganza at the local performing arts center. When we arrived, two facts became immediately apparent. The first was that it was almost impossible to see any of the actual magic tricks from the second balcony. They looked like a blur of gloved hand gestures, coupled with music that suggested we were missing a lot of mesmerizing eye contact. The other was that magic shows need something approximating magic. In the opening act, a tent rose from the stage, surrounded by a flutter of dancers. They twirled and waved their arms toward center stage for what felt like forever. But as the music crescendoed, and the dancers, in their final poses, began to tremble, we realized that something had gone very wrong. Some kind of hidden trap had clearly malfunctioned, preventing the magicians from appearing suddenly before our very eyes. Instead, nothing happened.
Nothing, except that the curtain descended to the muffled sound of two women laugh-crying into their sleeves from the second balcony. But I have seen a different kind of magic up close. I have seen parents of an autistic child, by special earphones, promise to clear out his ear canals and let him finally understand their adoring reassurances. I have heard accounts of parents buying their dying child a pair of shoes so that he or she might get up and walk. I have browsed through advertisements from preachers who mail out wallets with the promise that they will multiply the bills inside. I thought of them all as I handed $40 to my chiropractor for the special magnets that were supposed to restore strength to my arms, and then a little more money for the detoxifying foot bath that was meant to pull the impurities out of my contaminated body. At some point, I started to wear a special bracelet my friend gave me that had been advertised as a conduit for positive ions or something scientific sounding, which I wore because it made both of us feel better. I was trying everything and caring less about whether it made any sense. I just needed it to work. In the study of religion, we use the word magic sparingly because, so often, it is employed as a cheap way of describing faiths whose supernatural forces we simply don't credit. No, that dance did not make it rain. No, that buried statue in the yard did not help you sell the house. No, that special prayer did not heal your leg. The causality seems simultaneously too direct, this action yields this exact result, and too vague, like you're pulling on a thread with nothing at the end. By then, the 100 or so times that I'd sat across from a doctor, with a pen in hand and an exasperated expression, had become a blur. All I wanted was a name for what I had, a shorthand for why I still found myself unable to type, chop vegetables for dinner, or at least fake a cartwheel on the beach. My goodness, I was beginning to feel like an insecure girlfriend. Just tell me what's wrong with me. Is it me? It's me, isn't it? I was a month away from getting surgery to remove two of my ribs when I got a recommendation from a childhood friend who knew me when I was a cellist. Over the years, I'd seen a lot of great musicians suffer from different kinds of arm pain, and backstage, the unmistakable smell of Tiger Balm always lingered in the air. My friend is a drummer, and he mentioned that there were distinctive schools of physical therapy designed for musicians and dancers to address their particular injuries. Within a few hours, I had found the name of a local physical therapist who seemed to know something about what was happening to me. Our first meeting was a barrage of humiliations. She looked me up and down, shaking her head no, and asked me to walk for her. Touch the wall and come back. I touched the wall and came back. You walk like a gorilla, she said to me on my return. No, seriously, knuckles forward, slightly hunched, that's all gorilla. I laughed. I am an exceedingly loud eater and a consummate mouth breather, so this really completed the picture. Now lie on this bench and breathe into this blue balloon, she said abruptly. Not because she was socially awkward, but because there were a lot of completely random things she needed me to do. After I was done breathing into a balloon, she taught me a lot of weird reaching exercises, tested my vision through various geriatric lenses, and manually reset my ribs because ribs are like the chassis of a car. It was by far the weirdest appointment I had ever had. But even so, I heard myself saying, "Do you think you can fix me?" And I believed her when she replied in no uncertain terms, "Yes." She diagnosed my problem easily. I had been born with overly loose joints, and with all the sitting and typing for my dissertation, my natural asymmetry had become especially exaggerated. My body responded to this assault by seizing up around my joints,
trapping nerves and shutting down my arms. Even though she called me a gorilla, this was the woman who restored the use of my arms with a little-known school of bodywork called postural restoration. Presto. Just like that, a dark chapter of my life closed. It was the beginning of a series of gains for me. Ladders that were my escape out of the nowhere I'd been living. I landed my dream job at a major university seminary teaching the big survey of American religion to do-gooders of all kinds. I secured a contract for my first book. The publisher even let me do my own reading for the audiobook version. This was despite the fact that, 5 minutes into the recording, the sound technician piped his voice into the sound booth where I was sitting, marveling at my own prose. "Is it all, going to be like this?" he asked, knowing that we had weeks together of recording each chapter. "Yes," I replied, realizing too slowly that he wasn't offering me a compliment. Despite being aggressively boring, I was doing splendidly. Things were, in fact, going so well that the members of the storefront prosperity church I was studying started to take notice. Two of my favorite church women raised it with me. "Well, my dear, things are going really well, and you're hearing these great faith messages," she said, raising one eyebrow to evoke an answer. Her name is Linda, and not only is she the most devoted woman of prayer I know, but she always smells like sweet cedar wood when she wraps me in a hug. "It works, honey," said Valerie, a polished businesswoman and an endlessly patient answerer of questions about all things prosperity. "It really works. Just look at yourself." I broke into a wide smile. I was studying the prosperity gospel, but that day I was the prosperity gospel. I had become living proof at last. We have words to evaluate how likely it is that our attempts to harness the supernatural are of any use. Black cats and ladders and spilling the salt are put in a box dubbed superstition, and failed prophecies are classified as fantasies or delusions. But the prosperity gospel asks you to set aside your doubts and bet it all on God's supernatural power to reach down and remake the world according to your prayer. When everything in your body says, "Believe, believe, believe," when you find yourself turning to your neighbor and saying, "You can't imagine what I just saw," you are not just an observer anymore. You are a witness. So then the question is always, will it work? A prosperity-minded friend of mine once had a loved one die so young that he couldn't conceive of it, this flowering life snipped off at the stem. He and this friend had recently been teenagers together. One day they'd been running shoulder to shoulder down a dirt road, talking about their next lacrosse game, and the next, his parents were choosing among glossy woods for a coffin that would keep him in the ground. And so my friend called in all those closest and dearest to gather around the boy's coffin before burial and pray. They prayed all night, all day, and then the next, forgetting to eat or to sleep, buoyed by a confidence that he would be resurrected. "We just couldn't believe that God wouldn't resurrect him," he told me, shaking his head in exhaustion. "We couldn't believe it. We were so certain that it couldn't be the end." Only magic, only a miracle, could start their friend's heart. And as the hours passed in prayer, their furious love dissolved into fury at the God who'd left him cold. Didn't Jesus bring Lazarus back from the grave? Couldn't God do the same with the chilling body of a well-loved boy? They longed for a moment of suspended reality, their Lazarus moment.
The worst would be undone in the span of a prayer. Their dying dreams for this boy snapping back to life.